Preachers, there you go. Quote, one of the stories of the Chronicles of Narnia frequently, I've done it myself, I've heard it commented on over the years. And there's good reason for it. It makes us aware, I think, of a very common human tendency in the guise of children and animals and Narnia, the children's stories. I hope you're familiar with C.S. Lewis' great series of children's books, in which, in the land of talking animals, Christian theology is retold. The Christian story is retold with the Lord Jesus and the figure of Aslan, the great lion. And it's again a wonderful way to learn to think about the things of the scriptures, by coming at them from a slightly different angle. But the scene that I'm referring to occurs in the first book, and it's fairly early in the book, when the four children who, that begin the story first go to Narnia, and they first begin to see both difficult and wonderful things, and they're learning their way around, and they're in the home of Mr. and Mrs. Beaver. And Mr. Beaver tells them that Aslan is on the move. And, things are going to begin to change. It's been a long time, generations, since Aslan was on the move. But he is now. And so they begin to question him about Aslan and what does this mean. And they hear this story of the great lion that has died for their sins and also is coming now for their sake. And finally, Lucy, the youngest one, asks, hearing these disturbing things, "Then he isn't safe," said Lucy. "Safe," said Mr. Beaver. "Don't you hear what Mrs. Beaver tells you? Who said anything about safe? Of course he isn't safe. But he's good. He's the king, I tell you." The story of Jesus' lordship and his stirring and his interest in folks like us leads very often in the first telling of it to the hope that we will discover that he is safe. That nothing too difficult will be demanded, that changes too extraordinary won't take place, that good things will happen, but in a predictable and not too demanding way. And Lucy articulates the thinking of most of us. He's safe, isn't he? Of course he's not safe. But he is good. He is the king. The book of Acts is our text and has been for some weeks and will be for many to come. Chapter 10 today is where we are. You might want to turn there. But I hope you've observed kind of the obvious thing, and that is there's been nothing safe about following Jesus in all of the texts that we've studied so far. The Lord said to his followers in the first chapter that the gospel would proceed from Jerusalem and Judea to Samaria, the next ring of culture and experience outside of the land of the Jews, and then finally to the othermost parts of the world. The gospel is going to break forth. It is going to spread to places, beginning in Jerusalem, to everywhere. And the first seven chapters essentially are the story of the gospel in Jerusalem. And it wasn't safe there. It was filled with adventure and miracles and joy and prison and beatings and glory and honor and love. But it wasn't safe. And in chapter 8, we begin to see that under persecution, the gospel spread and it goes into Samaria, the next region, the near country around the land of the Jews. And most of chapters 8 through 12 are in this kind of secondary spread of the gospel to the near countries. And then beginning in verse 13, we're going to begin seeing the gospel go everywhere, to the ends of the earth. But we're in this kind of center section now. And there are three folks whose conversion stories are told in some detail in these chapters. The first is the story of an Ethiopian eunuch who is in every degree a complete surprise. He was evidently a convert to Judaism, a proselyte, but he is a foreign dignitary, a man who had been castrated, a man from kind of the edge of the earth, as it was considered then, Ethiopia, south of Egypt, a man of importance, a man who just happened in the middle of a desert, surrounded by his entourage, to be reading the book of Isaiah aloud at chapter 53 when Philip shows up and he asks him what it means. There's nothing in that account that is anything except surprising and challenging and wondering to us. The second conversion story that is also neither safe nor predictable, the story told in detail in chapter 9, we looked at it last week and the week before, of Saul's conversion, breathing threats and murder, determined to destroy those who love Jesus. And we have Ananias in Damascus who said, go to this man. He is one I have chosen. And Ananias is terrified. Oh, don't send me to him. He kills people. But he says, go. This is the one I've chosen. And again, we find ourselves amazed at the work of God, the ways of God, the choices of God. Now, the third detailed story of conversion is the one we're going to begin here in chapter 10. It's the story of another surprising conversion, a centurion named Cornelius. And we're going to take 2 weeks on this. It's because Peter, the Apostle Peter, has to learn lessons in order for him to participate in seeing Cornelius converted. He himself has to be challenged and changed. And we want to look at the text from his perspective today. Then next week we're going to look at many of the same details, but look at them from Cornelius' perspective. What do we learn by seeing things from the centurion's point of view? One reason to do this, again, just in the great scheme of things, is that this text is critical in the history of the church, making the point, the difficult point in the first century, that Gentiles were beloved of God, accepted by God, would have full status as members of the church without having first to become Jews. And that was a seeming impossibility. Jews and Gentiles had no interchange with one another. They were different. There was a chasm fixed between them, a wall built between them. And for the Jews to imagine that God would pour out His Spirit on Gentiles who were unconverted, uncircumcised, and not become Jews first was unthinkable. And Gentiles never expected it themselves. So this lesson of God's love for everyone, God's inclusion of everyone for free, is an important one. Now, for our sakes, we're familiar with Gentiles in the church. The vast majority of Christians in this century, and probably in every century, have been Gentiles. It's not a hard concept for us. But it was a very difficult one for them. And we want to kind of learn a similar lesson, about struggles we have that this story can comment on. Let me begin reading in verse 1 of chapter 10. Take a few moments to read this and kind of get the whole picture in mind, and then we'll look at it together. Now there was a man at Caesarea named Cornelius, a centurion of what was called the Italian cohort, a devout man, one who feared God with all his household, and gave many alms to the Jewish people and prayed to God continually. About the ninth hour of the day, he clearly saw in a vision an angel of God who had just come in and said to him, Cornelius. Fixing his gaze on him and being much alarmed, he said, What is it, Lord? And he said to him, Your prayers and alms have ascended as a memorial before God. Now dispatch the men to Joppa. Send for a man named Simon who is called Peter. He is staying with a tanner named Simon whose house is by the sea. And when the angel was speaking to him had left, he summoned two of his servants and a devout soldier of those who were his personal attendants. And after he had explained everything to them, he sent them to Joppa. On the next day, they were on their way and approaching the city. And when they were doing so, Peter went up on the housetop about the sixth hour to pray. But he became hungry and desiring to eat. But while they were making preparations, he fell into a trance. And he saw the sky open up and an object like a great sheet come down, lowered by four corners to the ground. And there were in it all kinds of four-footed animals and crawling creatures of earth and birds of the air. And a voice came to him saying, Get up, Peter, kill and eat. Peter said, "By no means, Lord, for I have never eaten anything unholy and unclean." And again a voice came to him a second time, "What God has cleansed, no longer consider unholy." This happened three times, and immediately the object was taken up into the sky. Now while Peter was greatly perplexed in mind as to what the vision which he had seen might be, behold, men who had been sent by Cornelius, having asked directions to Simon's house, appeared at the gate. And calling out, they were asking whether Simon, who was also called Peter, was staying there. While Peter was reflecting on the vision, the Spirit said to him, "Behold, three men are looking for you. Get up, go downstairs, and accompany them without misgivings, for I have sent them myself." Peter went down to the men and said, "Behold, I am the one you are looking for. What is the reason for which you have come?" They said, "Cornelius, a centurion, a righteous and God-fearing man, well spoken of by the entire nation of the Jews, was divinely directed by a holy angel to send for you. Come to his house and hear a message from you." To come to his house, to hear a message from you. And so he invited them in and gave them lodging. On the next day, he got up and went away with them, and some of the brethren from Joppa accompanied him. On the following day, he entered Caesarea. Now Cornelius was waiting for them and had called together his relatives and close friends. When Peter entered, Cornelius met him and fell at his feet and worshipped him. But Peter raised him up, saying, "Stand up, I too am just a man." And as he talked with him, he entered and found many people assembled. And he said to them, "You yourselves know how unlawful it is for a man who is a Jew to associate with a foreigner or to visit him. And yet God has shown me that I should not call any man unholy or unclean. That is why I came without even raising any objection when I was sent for. So I ask for what reason you have sent for me." Now it's a complicated story. It begins in Cornelius' house. It proceeds to Joppa, where Peter is staying at Simon the Tanner's. He's on the rooftop. He has a vision three times, back and forth, traveling one group one direction, the next group the next direction. And there's a lot going on here. And again, as I said, we're going to revisit this from Cornelius, in Cornelius's sandals next week. But what are the lessons that we can take from this and be challenged by regarding what Peter experienced and learned? Well, there's two of them, I think, two big ideas. One has to do with Peter discovering himself to be prejudiced and having that challenged. And the other is his confusion about what holiness consisted of. Learning to trust God and learn from God about a holy life, which he and hopefully all of us want to live as well. And I think these two subjects, prejudice and holiness, we can learn something about each of them, and I hope be helped from what we learn. What about prejudice? What does this text urge us to consider? What can we see here? Again, I'm assuming that most people in this room do not have a prejudice against Gentiles in general. My assumption is that most of us are Gentiles and that is not a category with which we struggle. But I'm also assuming that everybody in this room has some prejudice, some emotional reaction against classes of people that may even be hidden from your own view. It's very difficult to admit prejudices in the modern world. There are a few things more widely disparaged than exclusivity of any kind or distinctions between people. And so probably most of us are modern enough to disagree intellectually with prejudice. But again, I'm also assuming that most of us have been twisted by it, given our fallen humanity, and having an emotional reaction against classes of people that we should not. The triggers for prejudice can be varied. It can be obviously racial prejudice. It can be class prejudice. It can have to do with distinctions of wealth and poverty, educated or uneducated, those whose first language is something other than English, gender issues of prejudice regarding gender. It can have to do with nationality. It can have to do with culture from which you come. There's a bunch of ways in which people can be lumped together and disparaged or recoiled from, and And again, the question is, what can we learn? Well, the first question let me ask for us is, why did Peter, was Peter given a vision instead of sort of a clear explanation? And why was the vision repeated three times? What does this suggest to us? Now, Peter had heard the voice of God before. We know that he heard the voice of God at Jesus' baptism. You are my beloved son, in whom I'm well pleased. Sort of a straightforward statement of how things are. He'd heard the voice of God from heaven on the Mount of Transfiguration. This is my beloved son. Listen to him. Pretty straightforward. You know, a command to listen. It was clear. It was unambiguous. But in this case, instead of the voice from heaven saying, Peter, I want you to go to Joppa and talk to Cornelius about the Lord, which would have been sort of a clear, you know, command, he's given this sheet filled with animals. The animals include those that are both ritually clean and unclean for Jews. They would have had lambs and pigs next to one another in them, in the sheet. And we can imagine Peter's visceral reaction to seeing animals presented, you know, as prepared for a meal, you know, ready to be slaughtered for consumption, and to see pork and lamb sort of jumbled together on this sheet would have been revolting to him. And yet it's done three times, and he finds himself uttering the logically impossible sentence, "Not so, Lord." You can't call someone Lord and tell him no, but you know, in the same sentence, and yet here is Peter, you know, "Not so, Lord. I can't do this." Now, why go about it this way? Well, I think to make exactly the point that many of us have an emotional reaction to things that is very deep and hard for us to understand. To be just given the facts is not enough. We have to sort of see ourselves. We have to feel our stomach turn at seeing pork and lamb sort of presented together. We have to observe that we react in ways that are unhealthy, even at a level that we can't sort of attend to by just thinking about it. And it says that Peter, twice in here, it says that he was perplexed by what he saw, and he was reflecting on what he saw. He was wrestling with God. We can imagine him in prayer. We can imagine him asking what it meant. We can imagine him sort of, why? And I don't get it. And all my life I have made assumptions, and they don't seem to be correct assumptions. And he's churning, trying to understand, asking God to give him understanding of these things. And that must be true of us too, it seems to me. That if God would make the church really free to love, for each of us to love everyone, to make good assumptions rather than negative assumptions about people we haven't met yet, to reach out instead of recoil away from it, if we're ever going to be free and move forward, we're going to have to wrestle and struggle and pray and observe ourselves. Well, second thing I think we can see in this process of Peter dealing with his prejudice is that when he finally was commanded to act, he obeyed without hesitancy. In verse 23, he invited, it seems like he's in charge of Simon the Tanner's house. I don't know quite how that worked, but it's clear that Peter is in some sense the master of the house where he's staying as a guest, and he extends the invitation that they should come in and so on. He does what he's told to do. The same is true in verse 47. We didn't read that yet. When Peter preaches the same gospel that he preached at Pentecost, and that the Spirit comes on these Gentile believers, Peter makes the immediate connection. We should offer them baptism because they are as fully Christian as we are. So once the Lord sort of faces him with the issue and tells him to do something, he obeys. And that strikes me as an important step forward as well. We might wrestle with why we are prejudiced and why we struggle with certain folks. But once we're told to act in love, we should do what we're told. And one of the ways we change our mind about things is to change our behavior. And Peter is a good example of that. There are two wonderful references to hospitality in this passage. One of the things that was clearly verboten, that was clearly out of bounds for Jews in this time, especially regarding the occupying Roman troops, was to have an ordinary table fellowship, invited into one's house, an ease of conversation and hospitality between Gentiles and Jews. There's another story of a centurion. You may remember it. Luke tells it in his gospel, in which a centurion sends a message to Jesus saying, "My child is sick." My servant is sick. But he says, "Don't come. Just send a word and you're in charge and whatever you say is good and you can heal him from a distance." Well, the reason the centurion is so careful about that is he knew that it was shameful for a Jew to enter the home of a Gentile. That it would have tarnished the reputation of the great rabbi to have been even, to go near the home as if he was going to enter it. And this centurion is sensitive of Jesus' reputation. He says, "Don't even come here. Just give commands. They'll be acted upon." And yet in this text, it says Peter invited his visitors in. And then when he went to Joppa, he went into the home of Cornelius. And again, I say if we will make changes and grow up and become better at caring for people God cares for, to be expansive with our own homes and expansive with our hospitality and genuine in our enthusiasm for people and delighting in serving them in our home. And if we will go to their home and eat the food they eat and enjoy the world they live in and appreciate what may seem foreign or different, if we'll do those things, we will find ourselves learning and changing and expanding and growing. The Lord said, anybody can give hospitality to folks just like themselves from whom hospitality will be returned. Anybody can do that. Anybody can be nice to people who are going to be nice to you, and they're just like you anyway. But it's this wonderful, godly delight in learning to extend your hand to people who are different and then to receive the same from them. First time I traveled to Israel, I was 27. And this was in the mid-70s. It was a time of very much reduced tension in between Palestinians and Jews, Israelis. And it was a great tour. We went with an Old Testament professor. It was wonderful. It was a group of friends, very congenial group to travel with. And I loved it. The weather was great. The tensions were low. We got to go places nobody can go to anymore in the Holy Land. And I remember just thinking, you'd see the Bible on, every place you went, you'd see some, event that took place in the Bible. And you got to walk where Jesus walked. And, you got to see these things. And it just was completely wonderful. And Israel was sort of emerging and growing, succeeding at everything. And, the desert was blooming and there was enormous pride in the nation of what it was doing, how effective it was, and the changes that were being made. The sense of almost every Israeli you met was just how enormously proud of their country they were and their efforts and so on. And so anyway, all of this made a great impression, both the modern Israel and the ancient stones and places and events that we saw. But the person that made the biggest impression on me was a Palestinian. I have never forgotten that and the surprise that occurred in my experience. We were taken by this professor who was guiding our tour, and he took us into the old city of Jerusalem, into the Arab quarter, and into a place where they sold antiquities, into a shop that sold antiquities. And he said on the way in, there were just a couple of us that went with him on this particular trip, and he said, "I want you to meet one of the most godly Christian men I know." And it was on a tiny street that was Arabic in every, the language, the writing, the sounds, the smells, and it was Islamic mostly in all of its accoutrements, everything about the surroundings. And there was this little shop, and a man dressed just like his neighbors, with an accent just like his neighbors, an Arab Palestinian who loved Jesus and who was a member of a Christian community in his part of the world. We sat down and we talked about antiquities and we shared a glass of tea, and he wished us God's best for the rest of our time. And I didn't expect to meet the most impressive person on that trip in the Arab quarter of the Old City of Jerusalem. It was impressive stuff to see everywhere else. But the person, to my surprise, was one I wouldn't have guessed. And was actually, I would have needed some convincing to just be told the story rather than experience it firsthand and receive his hospitality and his blessing to sort of see what kind of man he was. So it's the overcoming of pride, prejudice, haughtiness, having distinctions be negatives instead of positives is something that we have a lot to learn about, and I think Peter can be a helpful instructor for us. I said there was a second issue. It's not just prejudice, but it's confusion. Peter felt like God was changing the rules on him. I grew up in serious Judaism. I have spent all my life avoiding eating things that I shouldn't eat. I'm doing it, I think, for your sake, and now you're saying that stuff has changed, and you will declare things which I previously assumed to be unclean to be clean, and you're changing the rules, it seems like. It's hard to know how to live a holy life. And it remains hard to know how to live a holy life, doesn't it? There is a difficult requirement that we face every day. It's the question of how to be different. You are not your own. You have been bought. You are bought with a price. You are owned by someone, not yourself any longer. You live in a culture in which you must stand out. You cannot be the person you used to be, and you cannot be as those with whom you live and work and in your neighborhoods, with all their values and all of their disinclination for God. You can't be like that. But at the same time, you can't be loveless and self-impressed and far away. You have, in the old phrase, you have to be in the world but not of the world. It's confusing. It's hard to know how to do that. It's hard to know how not to wake up like the frog in the pan of hot water and realize, without paying any attention, you have become, you're cooked. You've become just like the people around you. You are no different. The salt has lost its savor. There's no good to you anymore because you are just like everybody else around you. And say, Lord, please preserve me from that. Or to wake up one day and realize you are so far away in a tiny little world bounded by yourself and a handful of people just like you, that there is no capacity for love, the preaching of the gospel, the showing of tenderness. And yet, nobody wants to be in either place, but it's confusing. It's difficult. And it is a confusion I think Peter was facing here. And again, I hope we can think together about some of the issues that are raised. A couple of obvious points. First, there are moral categories that don't change no matter what, where there is no real debate. Joy to the World is a wonderful adventure around, if you did your passport thing, or you, or the children you were with, and you could go from Pakistan to Mexico to China to Indonesia and, everywhere else in sort of bounding around the world, and all of those are different cultures, and all of them, whoever lives there has to figure out, how am I going to live here and be a Christian? But there are places, there are issues that don't change. There are categories that remain firm no matter what. There is a moral fabric to the way God made things. And so Some choices are not at all difficult conceptually. They may be hard to do, to live them, but at least we know that theft and murder and adultery and other things of that sort are wrong and not to be countenanced no matter what. There's another category that is very personal. And I think each of us will arrive at some level of understanding if we listen at all to God about personal disciplines. There are things that you can't do because of your weaknesses. Things that I can't do because I have I have memories, weaknesses, struggles that mean stuff can be off limits for me, even though it's a perfectly okay thing. You know, the classic framing of that is to speak of alcoholism. People who say, I cannot have alcohol of any kind, any time, any place, even though someone else drinking a glass of wine can do it to the glory of God. I can't because that's my problem. Consider the guy that forbids himself to read the sports page. A gambling addict who was addicted to sports betting for years and has decided for himself that even though everybody else in the room can read the sports page, whether they should or not, they're free to do it in any case, but not him, because that's his struggle. So that's another category, and you and I will discover those things that are not good for us, even though the thing itself is morally neutral. But there's a third category that I think is conceptually the most difficult, and that's the kind of stuff that Peter was struggling with, and we'll spend a couple of minutes on here as we conclude. It was the ceremonial law for the Jews that concerned things like circumcision, diet, food preparation, appearance, even tithing and Sabbath requirements. And God required of the Jews that they make choices in the beginning when they entered Canaan as a nation, given the Ten Commandments and the laws of Moses, required them to make choices that marked them off from everyone around them. You have to be different. You may not worship their gods. The issue is idolatry. The issue is who you are going to trust. Where you will look for, the one to whom you will look to grow your crops. The one to whom you will look to provide for your family. And you will either worship God or Ashtaroth, you will either worship Baal or Ashtaroth, or you will worship Yahweh. And in choosing to worship Yahweh, mark yourself by these things. That you keep the Sabbath. That you circumcise your sons. That you refuse to eat pork and so on. And in order to tell yourself and in order to tell them that you belong to Yahweh, not the idols of the land, make these choices. The same is true even now, even in the first century when Acts is written. The gods of Rome, primarily Caesar and his army and the other sort of pantheon of gods, they do not deserve your allegiance. Only the Lord does. And so you're given means by which to choose one instead of the other. Well, the same dynamic occurs today, doesn't it? Circumcision is not an issue for us in the church. It no longer exists as a way of choosing God or not. It doesn't have that, doesn't carry that, that marker. It doesn't carry that, that inclination. Pork, eating pork or not, does not have make the same point. Whether we sew our clothing with two kinds of fabric together and doesn't have the same point for us. The ceremonial issues or the issues of choice, the issues of allegiance by which we claim Christ or the gods of this world are different, but we're still stuck with making some of those choices. Fasting. The spiritual disciplines may include things like fasting where for a day or some days you say no to invitations to lavish meals in order to spend time with the Lord. You may reject an opportunity to go skiing for the weekend because you want to spend time in church on Sunday with people who love you and love God. You may deny a investment opportunity because the money you would need to make the investment you've decided to give to the cause of the gospel or for the sake of the poor Now, skiing is morally neutral. It's not offensive to God. Investments are made every day by Christians honorably before the Lord. There are times when you eat lavish meals with a good appetite and praise God at the end. The thing itself is not in and of itself a concern, but there are times when for you, you have to say no to something. You have to make a decision to act or think or go or refuse to. Where you miss out on some wonderful entertainment in order to spend a day quiet before the Lord. It may even be that you say no to Christian activities in order to attend to God. I think a number of us have realized at times that one of the most voracious consumers of us are the opportunities to do Christian things on every side, and they increase and grow and proliferate. And so we're trying to say no to the idols that claim that money gives life. And the worship of activity for its own sake, and the notion that prominence and winning competitions and succeeding at climbing ladders really means something. Those are all idols, and at some point, we take hold of something and say, no, I will turn my face toward God in this day, in this time, with this thing, on this occasion, and I will say no to the idol because I need for myself to remind myself who I am, and I need to stand for something in the world around me. But it's hard to make those choices. It's not always obvious. We have to wrestle like Peter did with the Lord. Lord, is this the time? Is this the right thing? Is this a day you would have this for me rather than something else? And I think we can join Peter in realizing that we need God to help us to understand, to break through the confusion in order to live a way that's healthy to live. Let me make a couple of observations that just come out of my experience. One is that you have to say no almost always. Turning from this world's idols to God starts with a negative. You got to say no to something in order to say yes to God. But here's the danger. You say no to something in order to say yes to God. I will say no to this opportunity in order to devote this time to worship. I will say no to this chance to spend my money in order to give this money to the work of Christ, or whatever it is. But one of the problems is that saying no by itself can seem to be the end of the story. I think especially when you're down or discouraged or depressed or uncertain, and I see this in myself when I feel weakest and most unsure of myself, I look for something to say no to. As if that will please God by itself. You find ways to interpret life negatively. If I do less and reduce myself more and pull the covers over my head, somehow those things please God. But saying no, God has no pleasure in that. Saying no in order to say yes. It's choosing against something in order to choose for something, in order to embrace Him. Or take up a challenge offered by Him, or engage in life, either in quiet or activity or whatever, but a place where He is and concerns that He has. Sometimes, if we're not careful, just the saying of no. And Christians are often tarred with this brush, that we're all about denying things without ever having a hopeful contribution to offer. And that shouldn't be so. We say no, but we say no in order to say yes. A second lesson that might come from all these things we're considering is that holiness should never be about distance from people. We don't become different in order to be far from our neighbors and non-Christians and so on. If anything, it is to become the city set on the hill. The imagery used in the Bible was true of Israel. Israel should be a light to the nations. The Christian church should be a city set on a hill. You light a candle and you put it on a stand, not under a bushel. The point is to offer hope to other people. Not remove yourself further and further and further from them so that you can barely see them anymore. They're so far away. You have no contact with them at all and so on. That holiness ought to be a communicator of hope. God is good. And He will be good to you too. Not God is good and see you later. The last thing I would say in this is that just like Lucy, we often want our Christian experience to be predictable and safe and non-demanding. And so our year becomes routine. Well, I go to this retreat in the fall and this retreat in the spring, and I have these events that I do at Christmas time, and here's my Easter plans, and in the summer the family does these things, and the year's all planned out, and I know what to do, and on Tuesdays I go to this Bible study, and on Saturdays I go here, and Sunday nights I do this, and I have this conversation with these friends, and I have, you know, that everything, in an effort to be sanitized and Christianized, has become very predictable and very safe. And you know, 1 year looks like the last, and one conversation looks like the last, and so on. And what we're doing is avoiding the adventure in an effort to sort of mark ourselves as Christian. And that, again, that's a great foolishness. Aslan's on the move. He's not safe. He's good. He's royal, but he's not safe. And if we are really finding ourselves caught up with the presence of Christ in this world, the last thing in the world life will be is predictable and routine and inflexible. When the wind starts blowing, you know, where will we observe the presence of God? What places will we look for Him? Well, hopefully in church. But not just in church. Also in prisons and rehab centers and bars and country clubs and political conventions and fraternities, consciousness-raising sessions, poetry readings, tobacco shops, blues clubs, locker rooms, loud Pentecostal churches, tattoo parlors, army barracks, company boardrooms, secular universities, and everywhere else. That's where He will be when He comes, when He begins to stir and make changes. Those places and every other